You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. This is Annie and Tobiah.
Good morning.
And Anila.
Hello.
wake up. Yes, it's a beautiful day out there. It's still 17 degrees early in the morning at 5 a.m. See, I did the weather report. The moon was bright and shiny last night. I went and saw Marlon Williams last night.
Oh,
it was
wow.
So good. That man can do whatever. And they were just fantastic. But I'm here, so wake up.
Okay. I'm awake, Annie.
Yeah. We've got you've got to be awake for the Third World War, surely.
I don't this has been keeping me up at night, so yeah, I do need some help waking up because I've had many restless nights sleep over the last week. I think the situation is very much escalating. We've got some stats to get into about what's going on in terms of death tolls, but I think Toby was going to start off with a bit of an overview of what's been going on in the region.
Yeah, I'll just read from Dropsite News this morning, who published a pretty comprehensive report. I'll pick out some important or some more concise highlights. US and Israeli airstrikes pound Iran for a seventh day. Intense US and Israeli airstrikes hit Tehran and cities across Iran on Friday as the war entered its seventh day. Huge explosions were reported in residential areas of the capital and in the vicinity of Tehran University. Witnesses in Tehran told the AP that airstrikes were particularly intense, shaking homes in the area. Blasts were also reported in Shiraz, Qom, Isfahan and Kermanshah. At least 20 civilians were killed and 30 injured after US-Israeli strikes hit the Zibashar residential district in the city of Shiraz. Two paramedics are among the dead, according to the Tasnim news agencies. This obviously coming off the back of the reports that at least 13 medical facilities have been damaged so far, and amid the fact that evidence grows that the US is responsible for the deadly strike on the elementary school that killed 180 children.
They're liberating these people.
Yeah, they're liberating these people. It was reported by the WSWS, the World Socialist website, that the United States Navy torpedoed the Iranian frigate Iris Dina in the Indian Ocean. In the Indian Ocean on March the 4th, as a war crime, a submarine of the most powerful military force, they say, in the world, snuck up on an isolated vessel, posing no threat to anyone, gave no warning, offered no opportunity for surrender, and sent more than 140 sailors to the bottom of the Indian Ocean. The Trump administration has not offered a single word of justification. It has not claimed self-defense. It has not alleged imminent threat. It has offered nothing because it does not believe that anything is required.
And worth pointing out, this is coming straight from the top from Defense Secretary Hegseth. He said that it was the first time a submarine...
Secretary of War, Anila.
Yeah, sorry.
Get it right, mate.
It's the first time a submarine has sunk a warship since World War II, so...
Oh, well.
But, I mean, whether or not we want to buy into the kind of hype he's trying to create, it's definitely a sign things are moving. It's a war crime and it's a sign things are moving in a very scary direction. In terms of overall death toll at this point, it's been a week since these bombings started, since these attacks started, and at least 1,230 Iranians have been killed. That's according to the Foundation of Martyrs and Veterans Affairs, a body affiliated with the Iranian government.
I've noticed that the local commercial news on they've been playing it as if it's a little war, a skirmish that the US and the Israelis, and that they're the side we're supposed to be on.
Well, and also I think among the most ridiculous stuff, I mean, we watched just briefly with no volume, Nilay and I, just before we were coming on, the post that the White House made declaring the tagline is justice the American way, and it cuts strikes from like Iranian territory with famous movies like Gladiator and Braveheart and
scenes the most harrowing is scenes from Breaking Bad and Walter White kind of going
with Pete Hegseth saying stuff, and that's what on the White House official Twitter channel.
Like, that wasn't a person just having a fool around.
No, that's the official White House.
It's the official propaganda.
Yeah. And just to, like, that's ridiculous in itself, but so the submarine strike that hit this military, this Navy vessel confirmed, like, Albanese confirmed the Guardian's reporting that there was at least three Australian personnel on board, but that they weren't
In the submarine.
They weren't involved. They didn't participate.
The one that was doing the shooting, doing the war crime.
Yeah, they were in it, but they didn't participate in the attack. They just sort of sat it out. That's what Albanese would like to have you believe.
That will hold up in court.
Yeah.
On another note.
How miserable is that?
Shocking. Yeah. Lost for words, I think. Also, obviously, really big news, the death of Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Al-Khamenei. That was on the 28th of February last week. Donald Trump has recently said in an interview following that death that he must have a say on who is chosen as Iran's next leader. Trump has rejected publicly Khamenei's son, Murtadha Khamenei, who's the presumed successor of Al-Khamenei. Telling an Axios reporter, quote, "They are wasting their time. Khamenei's son is a lightweight. I have to be involved in the appointment, like with Delcy Rodriguez in Venezuela." So out and proud, kind of imperial aspirations being reported in the press this week.
You were showing us a photo of the head of Red Cross in Australia standing proudly at a function with the Israeli president that recently visited in Australia. They have no shame.
Yeah, so the healthcare workers have condemned the Australian Red Cross Society after its chair attended a welcome reception for Israeli President Isaac Herzog when he was here. Deep Cuts reporting the story. A Australian Red Cross Society chair, Claire Rogers, was photographed at the Sydney reception held for Herzog by New South Wales Governor Margaret Beasley on February 9th. In a media statement provided to Deep Cut, the ARCS said the photograph, quote, was taken at an event hosted by the governor, Her Excellency the Honourable Margaret Beasley, ACKC, to recognise the various organisations, including Australian Red Cross, who supported victims of the Bondi terror attack. So definitely not a political visit, this one.
Yeah, and not to talk about when they take photographs like this, they, you know, it's a bit like that old adage that you shouldn't have politics in sport. I mean, they are intrinsically political in their support of these people, and they are refusing to take into account the Red Crescent people that have been killed in Gaza, the Australians who went over as
Zomi Frankum that was targeted.
Yeah, I mean, ridiculous.
But also their obligation to uphold international law.
Exactly.
And these attacks have been shown to be illegal.
Yeah. And also, just as a sort of a boring little data collection, it would be quite interesting to find out how much money has been spent, public money that has been spent, whining and dining this character.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just to finish a story there, the nurses and midwives for Palestine released a comment to the press saying that as healthcare workers, we take an oath to protect human life and sanctity, and that this compromises the humanitarian mission of the Red Cross. It's reprehensible that Rogers, on behalf of the Red Cross or any healthcare or aid organisation, would participate in welcoming or assisting a mass murderer.
A bit closer to home, it was reported by The Age a couple of weeks ago that the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal, the VCAT, has ruled that Palestinian activist Hash Taye incited hatred against Jews when he led a chant of "All Zionists are terrorists" at a Melbourne protest in March last year. The ruling, which coincides with the recent formal opening of the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion, is the first ruling to make an explicit link between anti-Zionism rhetoric and hatred of Jews. It's fascinating that it should actually be in VCAT, especially if you go back and listen to the Greg Barnes analysis of the speech suppression laws that we played last week, because in court he maintained there would be quite a lot of argument around this finding these slogans anti-Semitic, but they go to one of the lowest courts. This is VCAT is the place where you go when you have a problem with your neighbours.
Yeah, or my landlord.
Are you a landlord?
No, yeah. My landlord doesn't fix my leaky sink.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's a very concerning ruling, because I think
it's setting up a precedent.
Definitely, and worth pointing out, Zionism is a political ideology.
Yeah,
it's publicly having it on the record that you are going to be punished for critiquing a political ideology that you don't agree with. One of your basic rights in a modern liberal democracy.
Yeah, very interesting. There were other couple of things that came up specifically in the Victorian context. You might have been really outraged as they want to topple the towers for public housing and not replace them with public housing, but with affordable housing, with all these public-private partnerships, which are supposed to be such a great solution to our social needs. A developer that branded itself the ethical alternative to a profit-driven industry is moving to slash affordable housing quotas at two major Melbourne projects, 2 years after the state government granted its controversial height concessions. This is reported by Rachel Dexter in The Age. The developer, Assembly Communities, has applied to the state government to water down the affordable components it promised at new builds in Brunswick and Coburg just months before construction finishes. Assembly's new development on Victoria Street in Brunswick, Justin McManus, under its proposal, the developer would ditch its signature build to rent to own model at the projects in Victoria Street, Brunswick, and Sydney Road, Coburg. Both were originally fast-tracked under the state government's development facilitation program on the proviso that 60% of the units would be affordable. The project bypassed local council oversight because of the 60% affordable purchase mandate. This fast-tracking in 2024 allowed the Coburg Towers to soar to 16 stories, well above the 10-story guidelines for the area. Boom, boom. Though, and now, of course, they go, oh, it's a fait accompli. What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it?
I mean, if you were cynical.
Well, I am.
It's never suspicious.
never apologise for being too cynical. What it's really saying is that all of this claptrap about private, public-private arrangements, housing needs to be affordable, and of course that's contentious in itself. The notion of affordability, very slippery kind of terminology, the idea of social housing versus public housing, where people think that social housing is public housing, which it isn't. It's in the hands of specific, maybe it's a new version of slum landlordism. Who knows? Who knows?
And
don't
the whole
quote
point
me on it.
Or also just withholding, sorry, Anila, just withholding tenancy to people that do because they don't fit some mysterious criteria.
Exactly.
Well, this is a great segue into what I was going to say, actually, because it just completely undermines the entire purpose of having public housing available to people. The point is that it's available to anyone that needs it.
That's right. And it makes it laughable that the government can trot out notions that are and false answers, ersatz answers to what is a fixable problem, pretending that it's the unhoused people that are at the that are the issue when they're not.
Basic responsibility of government. It's why we pay our taxes, so that they can provide services to people that need them.
Yeah, and not their fundamental function is not there to make private business profitable. Believe it or not, that's not the that is not the purpose of government.
Yeah, and also, I mean, on a personal note, I went and bought something that I needed that I bought off Marketplace at the public housing towers. That was where the bloke was meeting me. And you could go there. I went there, it was 11:30 at night. Just families hanging out.
Yeah.
It's just a completely normal place. If you go and sit down in the park, just go. I mean, probably most listeners would already know, but encourage your friends to just go there and understand what it is that is being
destroyed. Exactly. And just before we move on, unless you guys have got something else to say, I noticed that this really interesting thing, but it was reported by Koala by Tracy Harris, the subclass 485 visa is a post-study work visa that allows eligible international students to remain in Australia temporarily after completing their studies. The government has decided that it's going to double the fee for those people. So it started off at $2,000 the 1st of July last year, and it's now being increased to over $4,000.
Which
is kind of $4,600. It's been the cost of a temporary graduate visa application has doubled.
Which does make sense if you think about kind of the messaging, even from the beginning of the first Albanese government's term around migration. They're clearly trying to reduce migration, but also recognise how profitable of an industry higher education is. And a lot of that profit is coming from international students. So what better way of maintaining the profit you're making and also reducing migration than making it ridiculously expensive?
Isn't that horrific? If you were in the position that you were planning and hoping and doing all this stuff, because, I mean, it's not actually inexpensive to become a graduate, is it?
No.
You're on Solidarity.
And they're subsidising local undergraduates is also important to point out.
Yeah. Well, it's you're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie, Tobiah and Anila.
Anarchism 2026 is a public one-day conference hosted by the Anarchist Communist Federation coming up on March 7 at Ballumballum Place. Join us for a day of talks, panels and discussions exploring anarchist ideas, working class history and today's political landscape, as well as real organising lessons from on the ground. Tune in for such great sessions. We're talking fascism and anti-fascism, oppression and class liberation, rank-and-file interventions in our unions, the struggle for Palestine, BLF, green bans and the climate crisis, and that perennial favourite, Marxism and anarchism. Are they in fact in opposition, or might we argue something else? So if you're interested in a one-day conference on anarchism, check out Anarchism 2026, Saturday the 7th of March at Ballumballum Place in Brunswick. Tickets are available at ancomfed.org, that is ancomfed.org. The Anarchist Communist Federation is a 3CR supporter.
Cause baby, I'm an anarchist, you're a spineless liberal.
And And we're back. It's we're going to move to Voices for Palestine. This is a recording given to us by the wonderful Vivian Langford from the Climate Action Show, which, of course, plays Mondays on 3CR at 5 p.m. Because, you know, they've got a world to win. And this is a triple banger. It's got Josh Lees talking about Trump's peace committee. It's not called that, is it? What's it called?
Board of Peace.
Board of Peace. And it goes on to a voice from a Palestinian from Gaza, and then it finishes with Maureen Fariki. It was recorded on the 22nd of February.
We're here, of course, to keep up the fight for a free Palestine and to stop the genocide in Gaza. And the last week, yet again, has demonstrated what we're up against. Probably people have seen the shocking first meeting of Trump's board of billionaires, you know, his so-called board of peace, where all these absolute scumbags from around the world are gathering to discuss the fate of the Gaza Strip. Of course, not a single Palestinian amongst them. And of course, not a single person who cares about peace amongst them. Instead, this was a meeting of people discussing how they can continue the occupation of Gaza, how they can continue the ethnic cleansing of Gaza, and how they can profit from the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. So announced that meeting was planned to build, for example, a 5,000 troop US military base in the Gaza Strip, plans to have 20,000 soldiers occupy the strip, and plans to build luxury hotels, you know, on the mass graves, effectively, of the Palestinian people, in which, of course, no Palestinians will be able to live or to afford to live. This is absolutely sick. This is the kind of sick vision of the future that these racist, billionaire, genocidal warmongers have in store for the people of Palestine. And this is why we must keep fighting for a free Palestine. And of course, all of that is going to happen in conjunction with the Israeli military, who of course are part and parcel of all of these plans as well. So that's what we're fighting for, is a free Palestine and against this sick vision. And still, unless I've missed it, to this day, the Albanese government hasn't even said that they won't join this board of billionaires. Like, it's so shocking that they won't even say no to be part of this board of which Donald Trump is the head for life, whether or not he's US president, and whose clear mandate is to, you know, carry out genocide and profit from that. It's absolutely despicable. All right, before we go any further, I'm going to pass on to our speaker to kick things off, who, of course, you know, can bring home the reality of what we're fighting against better than almost anyone, and that is Shamik Badra, who's a Palestinian activist here from Gaza, and who, of course, has lost, tragically, so many of his family members to this genocide that our government continues to support. Thank you, Shamik.
Free, free Palestine! Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Gaza!
Free, free Gaza!
Dear friends and comrades, Isaac Herzog's visit wasn't a normal diplomatic event. It was a moral and political test. But this is not about the visit itself. It's about what happened during and after the visit. How protesters were treated, how voices were met, and what that tells us about the state of our democracy. We saw a red carpet rolled out of a man whose name is linked to a genocide in Gaza, and alongside we saw peaceful citizens exercising their democratic rights protests met with batons. And for many of us, this is not abstract political debate. This genocide wasn't distant from me. It was a direct cause of my own tragedy. Herzog came to Australia, a man whose name is tied to a genocide that turned entire neighborhood into ashes. We saw him sign shells that fell on civilians' home. These shells killed tens of thousands. Among them were my family, my friends, my relatives, and my neighbors. Shame. So, when I heard that he would visit Australia, and knowing what that visit represented, I didn't begin my protest in the street. I began with the law. I went to the government. I asked for a clear accountability. I received no response. Then, when I went to the street to exercise my peaceful right to protest, what did we find? People spray use against peaceful protesters. Rushing, restrictions, beating, arrests. Shame. In any democratic society, force should be the last resort, not the first message. When force is used without a clear or immediate threat, it shifts from protection to intimidation. Civilians who pose no dangers were treated as threats. When protesters are managed based on imaginary instead of actual behavior, the democratic balance begins to erode. So we must ask, when did conscience become a security threat? Democracy is not tested by slogans. It is tested by how it treats those who distant. And in this context, and in these circumstances, racism escalates in our society. Recent statements by Hanson linking Muslims to danger are not just ordinary political opinion. When an entire religion is framed as a threat, when Muslims are presented as security risk, this is collective generalization. This is racism. Comrades and friends, we are not talking about millions of Muslims or tens of millions, not even hundreds of millions. We are talking about around 2 million people, 2 billion people, Muslim around the world. There are some of them scientists, academics, doctors, engineers, writers, artists, thinkers, people who have contributed and still contributed to human progress. To reduce all this diversity, all this history, all this civilization into a threat, the question is, how does she place herself in the position to just 2 billion Muslims? In what knowledge? In what method? This is not serious analysis. It's dangerous simplification. It feeds fear instead of building understanding. It's a test of the state standards. Comrades and friends, we don't want division. We want cohesion. But cohesion can't be built on double standard. Yes. Cohesion requires one law, one standard, equal rights. If the law is used against the weak and ignored for the powerful, that is not justice. Comrades and friends, in these circumstances, when official doors close on Palestinians, we don't lose faith because we know there is something stronger than government, stronger than protocol, stronger than political calculations. There was something stronger. Who is it? You. You are the honest people. You are stronger. You stood with dignity. You were not afraid. You choose justice instead of silence. We rely on the conscience of the people. We trust you. Not because you hold formal power, because you hold courage. Our hopes rest upon the power of the people. Because you stood on the right side of the history. We believe this path will not fail. They tried to make the Herzog visit silent. But people responded from Sydney to Melbourne, to Perth, to Canberra, to Newcastle, to Wollongong, to Wagga Wagga. Stop injustice! Arrest Herzog! As a Palestinian from Gaza, I am deeply proud to have friends like you standing for justice. Proud of your courage, proud of your strength, proud that you didn't allow fear to silence you. You didn't march for hatred, you marched for justice, you marched for dignity. Respect to those who stood on the front lines. Respect to Palestinian Action Group. Respect to everyone who organized, endured, and didn't step back. To the people. The people are stronger, not only because we are many, but because we stand for justice. We are thousands, we are millions, we are all Palestinians. Comrades and friends, no one is above the law. Herzog has left Australia. He left surrounded by protocol, but he left knowing that people, don't forget, a red carpet cannot erase accusation of inciting genocide. It doesn't erase the blood of children in Gaza. Justice may be delayed, but impunity doesn't last forever. Some airport may open for some today, but history doesn't grant immunity. Gaza will remain strong. Palestine will remain alive. Gaza, Gaza, don't cry.
Gaza, Gaza, don't cry.
Palestine will never die.
So our last speaker today is the wonderful Marine Faruqi, the Green Senator. Make her feel welcome.
Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Ramadan Mubarak, Ramadan Kareem. Always was, always will be. We truly do live in an upside down world where police is allowed to punch, to pepper spray, to push, to assault, and to attack peaceful protesters standing up for justice, standing up against the genocide, while the Prime Minister of this country and the Premier of the state offer warm handshakes, a red carpet to a war criminal and someone who has incited a genocide. The absolute violence and brutality that police unleashed on elderly people, on women, on Muslims praying, on literally everyone that was in their sight was abhorrent. It was abhorrent, it's completely unacceptable and completely unjustified. I can tell you, as a Muslim, that this Ramadan, again, is going to be a very difficult one. Israel's genocide in Gaza is ongoing. The apartheid, the oppression, the expansion of illegal settlements, and the starvation and killing of children is ongoing. And in this country, the escalation of Islamophobia, of anti-Muslim hate, without much response from the Prime Minister, has made life extremely difficult for us. I mean, the Prime Minister can't even bring himself to use the word racism when it comes to One Nation. He could not bring himself to say that One Nation is a racist, hateful party. Has he forgotten that the leader of this party, the federal court of this country, found to have engaged in racist behavior? How much more proof do you actually need? If the way Muslims are being treated in this country at the moment, if any other religious group got that treatment, all hell would break loose. That is the honest truth. So it is incumbent upon us, it is our responsibility to call out these double standards and this hypocrisy. Because Muslims in this country deserve to be treated with dignity and respect. We don't deserve to be treated as targets of hate or as punching bags for politicians and their horrific political needs. So let's make sure, if these very basic human rights are not being afforded to us, then we demand them and we claim them. And I have heard from many of my Muslim brothers and sisters over the last couple of weeks. Many of them are scared. We are fearful, but we are also defiant. So let's make sure that we take that defiance onto the streets today and every day after this. Let's make sure that we are never silenced. And let's make sure that Palestine will be free. From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. Thank you so much, everyone.
So here's a toast to all the folks that live in Palestine, Afghanistan, Iraq, El Salvador. Here's a toast to all the folks living on the Pine Ridge Reservation, under the stone cold gaze of Mount Rushmore. Here's a toast to all those nurses and doctors who daily provide women with a choice, who stand down a threat the size of Oklahoma City just to listen to a young woman's voice. Here's a toast to all those folks on death row right now, awaiting the executioner's guillotine, who are shackled there with dread and can only escape into their heads to find peace in the form of a dream. Peace in the form of a dream. Peace in the form of a dream. Cause take away our PlayStations and we are a third world nation, under the thumb of some blue blood royal son who stole the Oval Office and that phony election. I mean, it don't take a weatherman to look around and see the weather. Jeb said he delivered Florida, folks, and boy, did he ever. And we hold these truths to be self-evident. Number one, George W. Bush is not president. Number two, America is not a true democracy. And number three, the media is not fooling me, cause I am a poem heeding hyperdistillation, and I've got no room for a lie so verbose. Yeah. Yes, I'm looking out over my whole human family, and I'm raising my glass in a toast. Here's to our last drink of fossil fuels. May we vow to get off of this sauce. Shoo away the swarms of commuter planes. Find that train ticket we lost. Cause once upon a time, the line followed the river and peeked into all the backyards. And the laundry was waving and the graffiti was teasing us from brick walls and bridges. We were rolling over ridges through valleys under stars. I dream of touring like Duke Ellington in my own railroad car. Of waiting on the tall, blonde wooden benches in a grand station aglow with grace, and then standing out on the platform and feeling the air on my face. Give back the night its distant whistle, give the darkness back its soul, give the big oil companies the finger finally, and relearn how to rock and roll. Yes, the lessons are all around us, and the truth is waiting there. It's time to pick through the rubble, clean the streets, and clear the air. Get our government to pull its big dick out of the sand of someone else's desert. Put it back in his pants with the hypocritical chance of freedom forever. Cause when one lone phone rang in 2001 at 10 after 9 on 911, which was the number we all call when that lone phone rang right off the wall, right off our desk and down the long hall, down the long stairs in a building so tall that the whole world turned just to watch it fall.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast. Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
You're back on Solidarity Breakfast, 3CR, your morning radio. I've got a little excerpt that I'd like to play from Gabriel Rockhill, who's an academic who just released a book called Who Paid the Pipers of Western Marxism. We haven't really been covering a lot of the Epstein stuff, but he has this little interesting excerpt from one of the book launches that he participated in, and we'll just play it for you.
I'll just say quickly with Chomsky, because it relates to a theme of the book. In a dialectical analysis, you have to recognize that subjects are just nodal points within an objective world that's rather complex. They have different sets of relations. And you have to account for the temporal vector because they do change over time. And so the idea of just identifying an intellectual and kind of sticking them to the wall like you'd put the pin in the back of a dead butterfly doesn't really make any sense because it doesn't account for both the complexity of the relations and the temporal vector. In the case of Chomsky, obviously he was a very smart person who was capable of doing interesting forms of analysis. And there's a lot that one could say on that front. And I know he brings a lot of young people in particular into politics in general. But on the flip side of it, if you know his history, he worked and was funded by the defense industry, the Air Force. He was at MIT doing work that was directly related to, even though he was always trying to separate it in various ways, the military-industrial complex. He also was close personal friends with someone who became the head of the Central Intelligence Agency. And Epstein, it's important to note, is just a limited hangout, right? What's important about Epstein in the big picture is who he was working for, who he was working with, and the entire network that they're very intent on not revealing and not dismantling. All of the things that are being revealed, raping 10-year-olds, torturing people, likely disappearing them, that is going on now, and they're intent on continuing it because that's the morality of the ruling class, and in particular, the decadent bourgeoisie that thinks all of you and all of us are disposable things and they can do anything with us. And in fact, it's enjoyable to use us as disposable things and trash human life. This is the morality of the ruling class that is the most powerful imperialist ruling class on earth today. I got a little carried away there with that point. I think I was talking about Chomsky, right? And Epstein. So the other thing that I wanted to mention is that he was a resolute anti-communist, of course, insisted on Lenin being a counter-revolutionary, which, I don't know, you got to flip history upside down to make that argument. And he was a free speech advocate and wanted to make sure that fascists always had their platform like a good liberal, right? You never want to shut down the free speech for fascists, because fascists always have to be maintained when the liberal rule of consensus under capitalism falls apart and you got to bring in the rough guys. He also played a very important role in pushing back against any materialist analysis that suggested that, in particular, the U.S. state was involved in very nefarious things such as targeted assassinations, false flag operations, terrorist attacks against its own citizen population, et cetera. But I'll just move on in the interest of time to, I really appreciated your comments regarding all of the different forms of organic intellectuals from whom we can and need to learn. Because ultimately, part of the lesson of my book isn't that we should wring our hands and think, oh, there's all these compromised Western Marxists. What am I going to do about it? The whole framing is a positive framing. There is a very rich, extremely developed collective tradition of anti-imperialist Marxism that's extremely developed across the global South. We have a lot to learn from that tradition. And part of the imperial superstructure's work has been invisibilizing, sidelining, and downplaying it. So everybody knows who Foucault is, but who knows who Raul Antonio Capote is? Everybody knows who Derrida is, but nobody's reading, I don't know, Antonio Barrero Vasquez or Nestor Cohan or many, many other people that we need to be reading and need to bring to the fore. And the last thing that I'd say is, yeah, there is no third way. We are in a pitched global class struggle in which there's an imperialist world system which is extracting value from the human beings and nature at such a level of social murder that it is pushing humanity to a complete and absolute breaking point. And the question for all of us is actually very simple. Intellectuals love to say it's very complicated. There's all these nuances. You can look at it from every angle. Maybe there aren't two camps. No, it's actually very simple. There's an imperialist world system that is demolishing the conditions of possibility of human life. And you either support that directly, condone it, or find other ways of supporting it implicitly. Or you line up and you say, I'm on the side of humanity. I'm on the side of nature. And what I want is a world where we can all live in some way a dignified life in which we have access to basic goods and services and where we don't have this plundering, corrupt, decadent, immoral financial ruling class that is intent on and is literally strangling all of us.
In every American community, you have varying shades of political opinion. One of the shadiest of these is the liberals. An outspoken group on many subjects. 10 degrees to the left of center in good times. 10 degrees to the right of center if it affects them personally. So here then is a lesson in safe logic. I cried when they shot Medgar Evers. Tears ran down my spine. And I cried when they shot Mr. Kennedy, as though I'd lost a father of mine. But Malcolm X got what was coming. He got what he asked for this time. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal. Get it? I go to civil rights rallies, and I put down the old DAR. DAR, that's the Dykes of the American Revolution. I love Harry and Sidney and Sammy. I hope every colored boy becomes a star. But don't talk about revolution. That's going a little bit too far. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. I cheered when Humphrey was chosen. My faith in the system restored. And I'm glad that the commies were thrown out from the AFL-CIO board. And I love Puerto Ricans and Negroes as long as they don't move next door. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal. Ah, the people of old Mississippi should all hang their heads in shame. Now I can't understand how their minds work. What's the matter, don't they watch Les Crane? But if you ask me to bus my children, I hope the cops take down your name. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal. Yes, I read New Republic and Nation. I've learned to take every view. You know, I've memorized Lerner and Golden. I feel like I'm almost a Jew. But when it comes to times like Korea, there's no one more red, white, and blue. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal. I vote for the Democratic Party. They want the UN to be strong. I attend all the Pete Seeger concerts. He sure gets me singing those songs. And I'll send all the money you ask for, but don't ask me to come on along. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal. Sure, once I was young and impulsive, I wore every conceivable pin. Even went to socialist meetings, learned all the old union hymns. Ah, but I've grown older and wiser, and that's why I'm turning you in. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal.
From Fitzroy Primary School, and you're listening to Community Radio on 3CR.
A weak solidarity bricky team listener, when US of the UN of the US of the world, Big Supremo Donald Trump of the poor, and Zion Supremo Benjamin Not Another Yahoo continued their campaign for a joint Nobel Peace Prize. Well, Donald wouldn't want to share it after all. When or if they finally stop slaughtering evil Iran, he will have stopped yet another war. And how proud we are that True Blue Aussie was the first US of and Zion acolyte to support the attack, while refraining from stating whether we thought it was legal. In fact, that must rest with the perpetrators, Big Supremo Anthony Albanese and the Minister for Going Overseas all the time, and being a perfectly good little prefect, Penny Left-Wing asserted. Trying to recall if that's what they said when evil Russia invaded Ukraine, for instance, and Penny said we don't comment on that place when asked if Pine Gap was involved in the Peace Prize killing. Speaking of which, again, Donald boasted over the deaths of Iranian rulers, forgetting that more than 150 children had been killed when their school was bombed, obviously terrorist children. 150-plus children contributing to Donald's Peace Prize. And, well, we can but imagine how Benjamin would feel at the mass slaughter of innocent children, the euphemistic collateral damage. Like the Lebanese, Benjamin decided to invade at the same time, although in fairness, he's never stopped invading them. After all, that death and destruction, when a couple of US trained killers were themselves killed, Donald said evil Iran would pay for this crime against humanity. Someone should remind Donald that when you start trained killing, there's every chance, like 100% chance, that the other lot will fire back. The reason for the slaughter was clear. Well, reasons, because Donald had a new justification every day. His oh-so-compassionate Secretary for War for Trained Killing and Slaughter, Peter Hug Killstuff, also a different story every day, and the Secretary for US of World State, Marco Rubiatio Cuba, had one reason one day and the opposite reason the next. So that's pretty clear. Donald did say he hoped the Ayatollah would not be replaced by another lunatic. Shades of the US of 14 months ago, when these lunatics seized the White House and, more pertinently, the Pentagon. All those lovely toys for the boys. And full marks to the True Blue Aussie Capitalist Review for getting the thousands of deaths into perspective, aware that war, train killing is violent. Saying so in huge P1 headline Thursday, yes, the market reaction to war threatens to become violent. Stuff the human victims. It's the market, stupid. No, no, if the filthy rich become a little less filthy rich, they're the real human victims. Poor dears. Well, slightly less rich dears. Then again, in arguably the most egregious exploitation of genuine human suffering and death, some filthy rich getting filthy richer through a mob called Polly Market, which runs bets on world events, some making up to $1.5 million killing on the killing by betting on when the US would invade. Some, perhaps the same people, also made millions betting on when he would invade Venezuela. Morality run riot. And with such morals, what a surprise. There are suggestions some people are betting with inside information, insider trading, so to speak. Who would have thought? Donald's commitment to a rules-based world order and legality shone again when Spain, unlike courageous True Blue Aussie, declared his invasion illegal and banned US of killer planes using Spanish bases. We can land without Spain's approval. Nobody's going to tell us not to use them. Guess who exploded? See? Respect for the US OBS rules-based world order. And the demise of His Most Gracious Majesty's home country Supremo Keir Starmer after 14 months of kowtowing. Wonder if Anthony and Tenney and the Minister for Being Offensive and Train Killing Colonel Maul's the bad guys, he of the giant mind, ever think, despite all their boot-licking and bum-licking and brown tongues, one small slip and bang, all that aggrandizement vaporizes like fairy floss. Still, His Most Gracious and Keir can take some consolation that True Blue Aussie has just handed them yet another $300 million as part of the onomatopoeic Caucus deal. And that left-wing visionary trained killer industry minister Pat Conraygun agreed British missiles could be tested in True Blue Aussie, just like they tested their nuclear bombs on land where no one was affected, because the only people there were Terra Nullius non-land non-people, so there were no people on the no land. And wasn't that one of the great success stories? As a by the by, and we've certainly got no time for the theocratic butchers running Iran, but the celebratory protests are also disturbing. A mixture of Iranian and Zion flags and photos of the son of the deposed former butcher, who hasn't been near the place for decades. The caring business class was out and about advising the government on what's needed to make the greatest little economic order of them all even greater. Step one, curb reliance on government. The Business Profits Council ordered all that spending on people with disabilities, pensioners, the unemployed, is killing the economy. These sponges must pay more themselves from the money they haven't got. Killing the economy, which desperately needs, a tax regimen that does not cripple the caring business class, presumably through avoiding them altogether by meeting their legal tax obligations, spending the taxes they don't pay instead on increasing productivity and getting rid of the onerous caring business class relations laws the socialists have introduced, like same job, same pay, and the right to disconnect, and worse, going home nights. We didn't say equal pay for same work, of course, although reported last week the socialists are boasting they have reduced the gender pay gap to a mere 11.5%. Boast. They can boast when it really is equal pay. Anyway, figures this week confirm the 11.5%, and interesting juxtaposition. True Blue Aussie Capitalist Review report with the masthead and caring employers declaring their commitment to equal pay. Then, very next page, full page ad for the Asia Pacific Financial and Innovation Symposium. Should be one of the great days out. With photos of 10 high finance, big time speakers, people who make money and make money and nothing else. And how many were women? Exactly one. So woman, not women. The True Blue Aussie Resources and Energy Employer Profits Association, representing the caring transnational fossil polluters, made a very strong and logical case for government to resist worker campaigns for better wages and conditions, pointing out the, quote, outdated law, which saw BHP, for bloody huge profits, bloody huge polluter, fined for forcing workers to work on Christmas Day, must be rescinded because it ignores the reality of the modern 24/7 workplace, continuous shift-based fly-in, fly-out operations. And record-keeping requirements must also be relaxed. The system has shifted from protecting employees against underpayment to penalising employers for paperwork defects. Sensible stuff. But just as we'd expect, the bloody evil unions disagree, won't listen to reason. The association, which represents some of our wealthiest mining companies, is arguing workers should go backwards by allowing employers to force workers to work public holidays. Not only that, they would give bosses a leave pass so they no longer need to keep proper employment records. The ACTU raved. Worse. The ACTU is also pushing for an extra week's annual leave. Do they think caring employers are made of money? Disastrous timing. Our old mate, True Blue Aussie Industry Profits Group Supremo Innes, will cost the workers, bemoaned. We already face a productivity crisis driving up inflation. An extra week off will just make these problems worse. Only those living in a fool's paradise would agree with the idea, it has told us. Evil unions and workers have no sense of timing, do they? Every time they ask for more wages or improved conditions, caring employers are forced to warn that the time is not right. There is, of course, a simple solution. The evil unions and workers must wait until the caring employers tell them the time is right for higher wages and conditions, improved conditions, and problem solved. Another caring employer, After Profits Pay, which took 1,300 staff to California late last year to celebrate massive profits, free-flowing alcohol, musicians, all the works, a mere $68 million of thanks. Then this week, it sacked, sadly had to let go, downsized by 40%. That's a lot of workers on the scrap heap. Thanks and no thanks. Seems it's discovered AI can do the work. And what a saving. Take AI to California to celebrate, no alcohol, just consuming heaps and heaps of fossils and water, and it can play its own music to itself. Win-win. Domin on the Nose Pizza, those ads dripping with elastic strands of salt and fat, announced a new Supremo it hopes will drag it out of a profit doldrums, a bloke who has held senior positions with McDonald's salt, sugar and fat for years, who will, quote, make a significant contribution, Chairperson Jack Cowan crowed. And we agree, a significant contribution to the health and undertaking industries. Finally, two commemorations this weekend, thankfully rendered benign. International Working Women's Day, emanating from working women's struggle, but thank goodness it has been adopted by the establishment and celebrates caring business class women, erasing working from the title, forcing us to criticise this station for thumbing its nose at the establishment and devoting the whole day to celebrating working women. Shame, 3CR, shame. At least small men on public land will vroom their way at great public expense to turn people's minds to truly important matters. And Labor Day. Years ago, huge marches, evil unions, huge floats and banners and lazy avaricious workers. Who wants to celebrate workers when we can celebrate Moomba and fun? Indeed, when Moomba seized Labor Day, it banned unions from the fun Mickey Mouse Parade. Bread and circuses, let them eat cake. Let working women and men glorify the greatest little economic order of them all. Although, a jarring return to reality. Donald told us, if crazy people have nuclear weapons, bad things happen. Crazy Donald, that's a worry. Good morning.
Yeah, he's right. That was Kevin with This Is The Week That Was. You're back with Annie and Tobias and Anila on Solidarity Breakfast.
Aren't we going to do our good morning, Kevin?
Oh, yeah, good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Kevin. Is that a new tradition? We've got Don on the line. G'day, Don. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Annie, and really pleased to be back and very pleased also that you're back in Australia.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. We're specifically talking to you about Cuba because you've been a long-term member of the Australian-Cuban Friendship Association, haven't you?
Yes, well, it's called the Cuban Children's Hospital Fund.
Okay.
I was persuaded to join at the pain of all sorts of consequences by the late Taz Bull, who used to be the National Secretary of the Maritime Union of Australia. And he started the fund up in very unique circumstances in 1997 and persuaded a lot of us, including in the, if you remember, the Organising Works programs, in, around that period, a lot of people joined then, and a lot of his old friends in the union movement and migrant communities had joined as well. So I became one of them, and I'm currently the president of the Cuban Children's Hospital Fund, yes.
And recently, because given the pretty outrageous negative behaviour of the US, the Cubans are in a fairly polis condition at the moment, aren't they?
Yes, well, there's, it is pretty outrageous what's being done to Cuba right now, and specifically what's being done to its people. And so just from a humanist point of view, we need to sort of be thinking about, well, just what is the United States of America up to in the Caribbean, but specifically in Cuba right now? And then secondly, is the implications for the professed Australian government support for the rules of the international order. And we might come back to that later on. But
no need yeah, so to stand on.
The direct intent of the US policy relative to Cuba for 60-odd years has been deliberately and in its own words to make life miserable for the population through an economic blockade so that life will be so miserable, and this is the theory, that the people will rise up against their socialist government. And one of the spin-off effects of that, of course, is to deliberately try to undermine the very high priority that the Cuban government gives to its public health system. And so our focus in providing solidarity support is to provide practical solidarity to the cardiopediatric centre in the William Soler Public Hospital, which is in Havana, and to support where it suggests we should, its system of, I think it's 9 clinics that are spread around the island for its population of 11 million people.
And so you recently actually got through some of the cannulas that they needed to be able to do this absolutely vital work.
Yes, well, the most recent request we had, and the system we use is that we provide practical solidarity, equipment and supplies on request and as defined by the staff at the cardiopediatric centre. And their most recent request was a problem with cannula, the connectors of various fluids and bloods and so on into the veins, and called cannula or cannulae. And they were getting desperately short of those for tiny babies who were being prepared for an operation or waiting for one, and for small children. So we're talking about pediatric cannulae that were needed. And we worked out an arrangement to be able to get a shipment into Cuba just at the beginning of last week.
How you actually managed it?
Well, it's really it's both straightforward and tricky at the same time. But firstly, we, as I said, we get the priority confirmation from the centre itself, from Dr. Solomon, who is the director and chief surgeon. And he works with his staff to work out what's needed, and then he advises us. We then go searching, sometimes with his help, for a supplier of what is needed. We open a discussion with that supplier, and the supplier, to the degree necessary, locates a manufacturer, and then just through normal transactions that avoid any connection to the USA or any material connection to the USA to get the required goods into Havana Airport in the first instance and then to the hospital.
Just speaking there about the kind of very direct relationship between what's going on internally in Cuba and the kind of protracted campaign of the US to suffocate the country economically. But we're also seeing that it seems like the US government is shifting towards being interested in intervening militarily. We had Trump saying this week that Cuba's at the top of his list for regime change after Iran, and that it's only a matter of time before they increase their military intervention in the region. So could we talk a bit about what you're seeing happening in the region militarily?
Yes, well, you're spot on. The suffocation of the Cuban people is founded in an economic blockade that's been going for 60 years that Trump intensified in his first administration and has raised to a new pitch in this current administration, particularly led by this character, Marco Rubio. And as you say, the suffocation is now reinforced by a military blockade that illegally interferes with and blocks trade by any country with Cuba. And so that included Venezuela with regard to oil for fuel to operate the economy. And it involves other countries as well. There's one or two exceptions from Mexico, in which goods have been able to get through on a humanitarian basis, and the consequences that might flow if the USA militarily blocked a Mexican aid ship. So, yes, you're dead right. It's an escalation, and the reason is because Cuba, particularly, not only, but particularly in regard to its priority on public health, is a direct threat to the ideological value system of the United States that says that the primary purpose of healthcare provision is profit-making, not the care of people. And so if you have right on the doorstep, just 90 kilometres away, a small country of 11 million people that is able to operate a healthcare system despite the severity of the blockade in 60 years, that prioritises and puts first the needs of the people, then that is a threat to how it breaks apart the American value system. And they hate that. And they're determined to wreck it. And the determination of the Cuban people matches that with the determination to defend it. And we say, well, we ought to take sides here and be on the side of the Cubans in being able to defend and develop their healthcare system and, of course, the spin-off effects to other parts of daily life.
There's an interesting announcement that medical brigades. The Cubans have supported health brigades to other countries that have required, who need health support, doctors, nurses, and they've really punched above their weights. But some of these countries are now expelling those medical staff because of pressure from the US. Do you know anything about that?
Not in great detail. I do know it's happening, but I'm not going to be able to comment in any great detail, except to say this. What I've been saying about Cuba is that it is an example. This is why it's a threat to the United States. It is an example of a socialist approach to humanism. And there are many examples, but the medical brigades that go to populations in countries that are in dire straits because of a natural or climate change imposed disaster.
Yeah, we're talking about Dominican Republic, we're talking about Haiti, we're talking about all these amazing interventions that they've made.
Yeah, Haiti is a good example. And so they send a blockade. Now, the medical brigade teams consist of maybe 10 people, or it might be, you know, a couple of hundred people. But they go to any part of the world where the country will accept them, and they provide practical support to the most impoverished, the most harmed by a natural disaster. And so they are an exemplary example of how socialist humanism works as a solidarity on request type framework. And so the United States cannot match that. When it provides aid to another country, it is deliberately intended to create dependency of that country on the United States system. The Cuban system of providing medical brigades is to enable the country and the people itself to rebuild their health provision and local community infrastructure.
You were telling me something really interesting about Australian connection with Cuba, because about a literacy program that First Nations people went across to Cuba to find out about, and they were supported by Cuban literacy people. Tell us about that.
Well, I'm no great expert on the literacy program, but Cuba practices solidarity aid for literacy programs the same as it does with the medical brigades. And there is a really good example amongst a group of Aboriginal communities in northwest New South Wales, and there are other people better able to explain its history and so on. But they found that they were not able to succeed in developing English literacy, in this case, amongst Aboriginal children, and so they turned to the Cubans for assistance. And that assistance was provided into those communities, and it actually reversed the problem and developed a significant growth in school attendance and associated literacy in those communities. Now, as I said, I'm not an expert on that, but there are people who can talk about that in the Australia-Cuba Friendship Society.
But it speaks directly to way of thinking and a way of approaching human issues that Cuba has to offer the world, and diametrically opposed to this fascistic arrangement that's coming out of America at the moment.
Well, that's dead right. I emphasise that socialist humanism as practiced by Cuba means that when it provides those forms of solidarity support, solidarity aid to other people, it's free. They don't charge for it. There are no consultancy fees.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right. You don't need one of those.
It's an opportunity. It's a humanist practice. So to return to the hospital, the Cuban Children's Hospital Fund, perhaps. So, as I said, the late Taz Bull set up the whole thing, and there's we're all aging now, so I wouldn't say that we're quite thriving as it was at our peak. But we have, as well as getting the cannulae into the cardiopediatric centre last week. We've got two projects coming up in which we hope to get a second shipment in because they are desperate for them because of the intensification of the Trump blockade. But also we're looking at being able to buy a state-of-the-art hematology monitoring device. Over the period of Taz's leadership and then since he died, we've managed to get a whole lot of things into the hospital for the children. And they include neonatal beds, they include a sternal saw, this is just part of a longer list, surgeon's headlamps, state-of-the-art, so that they can improve the actual procedure. And of course, during COVID, we got in a significant shipment of pediatric type syringes that the Cuban system was running short of because of the blockade.
So how do you get people to help you out? You know, here's a little bit of a stage. Can you give people, our listeners, some sort of idea about how they might be able to contribute?
Well, the fund is managed through, it's our activism that does it, but it's the fund is actually managed by Union Aid Abroad, or AFIDA, and we're very grateful for that. And they've done a great job supporting our small project. And so people, there are a group of people declining, unfortunately, but that's the honest truth, who make a regular monthly donation to a feeder designated for the Cuban Children's Hospital Fund. And so anyone listening who would like to do that or just make a one-off donation can do that by checking out the AFIDA website, and I'll put some details about that up at the Cuban Children's Hospital Fund Facebook page later this morning. So anyone can make a one-off donation if they wish to.
Thanks for talking to us today, Don.
Well, we haven't talked about how this fits with the new international, or the so-called rules-based international order.
And well, there isn't any.
On the whole, a positive story there, on the whole, in its general direction, which is unusual on foreign policy these days. And we should talk about that at some stage.
Okay. Well, next time we catch up, that's exactly what we'll talk about.
Yes, and there's so much more. All the very best to everybody. And Cuba's really important because it sets an example about what socialist humanism means in practice in defiance of the empire.
Tune in to 3CR's annual International Women's Day broadcast.
On Sunday, the 8th of March, we'll be bringing you 24 hours of women's news, views and music.
Talking, a gender analysis of contemporary issues.
Gardening.
Peace and disarmament,
workplace struggles and the union movement,
strong women self-advocates with disability,
environmental justice and direct action,
why animal advocacy is a feminist issue,
Indigenous women's struggles fighting assimilation and land expropriation,
the modern history of female gender diversity,
celebrating 21 years of Out of the Pan,
and delving into our archives
to pay tribute to 3CR's 50 years of radical women's voices on the airwaves.
From midnight Saturday on the 7th of March until midnight Sunday on the 8th of March, we'll bring you 24 hours of radio by women presenters, producers and musicians.
For details, go to 3cr.org.au/IWD2026.
Kon Karapana Jyotidis OAM overcame his traumatic childhood of racism, bullying and loneliness to help create one of Australia's largest and best-loved human rights organisations, the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, which has transformed the lives of thousands of refugees and has helped build a movement. On Sunday, March 15 in Clifton Hill, Korn will join Petrina Barson, director of the Center for Compassionate Society, in a conversation about compassion in action. This is a rare opportunity to hear Korn share not just about the issues facing refugees and asylum seekers, but about himself. What inspires, energizes, challenges, and sustains him in his work? Find out more and register through centerforcompassionatesociety.net, a 3CR supporter.
And that's it. That's a wrap. What do you want to say, Anila?
We've got to announce that there's a student strike for Palestine happening this
on
coming
the 11th?
Week, on the 11th. So get out there. In Melbourne, it's at the State Library at 2 p.m. So make that in. Make sure that's in your calendar.
And I'll just say quickly, if there's any Italian listeners that are registered to vote, the voting cards are arriving this week. And if you need any more information, tune in to Radio Philf 6:30 this coming Wednesday, and there'll be an excellent report from the women taking over the broadcast in honour of International Women's Day. But also there'll be more referendum information, and keep an eye on our socials to know why to vote no.
Okay, and we're going to go out with an oldie but a goodie.
Listen up, we've got a war zone here today, right in our heartland. And across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they've declared a war on us, fight back, it's up to you. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers, and it's time we started calling the shots. Going to work could be the death of you and me, but we're not unarmed. Our weapon's solidarity, Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood, the list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers, and it's time we started calling. When they boost your copay,
war on the workers.
Don't you know what to say?
War on the workers.
When they talk privatization,
war on the workers.
And cooperation,
war on the workers.
When they call you a team,
war on the workers.
You better learn how to scream.
War on the workers.
Oh, that's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Flexibility.
War on the workers.
Every worker stiff can see.
War on the workers.
Now when they poison your water.
War on the workers.
Don't go like lambs to the slaughter.
War on the workers.
And when they foul up the air.
War on the workers.
You gotta show that you care.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.